So today's FAQ session is on that classic put down, great idea, but it'll never happen. And I bet you've all had the same experience as me. You've been there one time. You put in the case for socialism. It's all going swimmingly. You're on fire. The arguments are flowing. You're weaving your word magic, and the audience are nodding. And then someone says, "Yeah, but you know what? It'll never happen." And then all the crowd sort of agrees with that, and your whole argument seems to sort of fall to bits immediately. And the worst thing is, there never seems to be a good comeback to that. You could say, well, I've often said, why do you say it'll never happen? The problem with that is that you've then ceded the advantage, and now you're on the defensive while your opponent is pressing the attack. A minute ago, you were the one pressing the attack against capitalism. Now you're on the back foot, while your opponent comes back with this thing called common sense that everybody knows is true. And then what happens if you ask why they think it'll never happen and they give you a reason like human nature? What then tends to happen is that the conversation gets sidetracked and it disappears down a rabbit hole, where before you were on point and you were attacking capitalism and putting the case for socialism. Now you find yourself quibbling about some aspect of human nature, behavioral genetics, or some study in Sweden or something, and the whole conversation has got derailed. You've lost the focus and you've lost the audience. You know, people wander off bored. Theory doesn't seem to really work anyway in situations like that. I mean, even if you knew tons of scientific studies, you know, you could quote them until the pub shuts, but it's not going to do any good, because somebody who says it'll never happen in that way that they have, they've kind of already decided that it won't happen, whatever you say. So how do you undercut this bit of received wisdom? A thought that occurred to me was that people tend to say this as an alibi for their own lack of engagement. You know, they don't want to do anything themselves. And this kind of fatalism, it's a perfect throwaway excuse to do nothing. If I'm right about that, that might be a way to recover the lead in the conversation by instead of talking about whether it'll ever happen, talking about the person's own motivation instead. So something like, do you mean it'll never happen, or just that you're not going to do anything about it? I can't say that I remember ever trying that approach with anyone, so I don't know if it would work or not. Maybe I did. So what do people think? You've all definitely had this thrown at you, undoubtedly. Every socialist does. What have you found? What ways past this conversation end have you found? You know, ways that don't derail the discussion into some sort of cul-de-sac. So over to you.
I'm happy to kick off here if you want, guys. I've been absent for a couple of these discords, so I'll throw in my top and slip if it's okay. I tend to throw it back in such a way that I generally say, well, it'll never happen so long as you keep saying it'll never happen. The reality is it's not a question of if or when, but that it must happen. And these are the reasons why it must happen. And then you can pull them back in and get back on track with explaining why, not so much that it'll never happen, that it has to happen. And the only reason it won't happen is because you keep saying it won't happen type of thing. And that's usually how I hit it, sort of head on. And, you know, throwing it back, say, you know, you're the great doubters and the pessimists, and the important thing is to stay focused and keep campaigning and propagating the argument for it, rather than just throwing the towel in and saying that it'll never happen. That's far too defeatist, and the important thing is to remain positive and optimistic and work towards making it happen type of thing. Usually what I do.
Well, I get that, Paul, but it's a bit like, you know, if you can take the analogy of Christians for a minute, you know, they talk about if you behave yourself, you go to heaven. And we would say to them, yeah, well, we don't believe in heaven. And they'll And their answer would be, well, you're just being negative and pessimistic. You know, you've got to work for it and then you'll get to heaven. The problem isn't that, you know, the problem is that they don't actually believe the image that we're giving them. They think, they act as if we're describing heaven and they don't believe in heaven. Do you see what I mean? So it's not a case of, oh, you've got to, it's got to happen and you've got to not be a sort of doubting Thomas and be negative. They just basically don't believe the picture.
Mm. Well, I think if you can paint a positive enough picture and try and win them over by saying that it is perfectly tangible, it is achievable, whereas the other thing that you mentioned is really quite it's pie in the sky, it's unreasonable, it's unrealistic, it's just not... It can't physically happen, you know, because no one knows, or there's no scientific basis for it. Whereas socialism hasn't been tried, but right now it's an idea, and it's an idea that can be borne out when the majority of people agree that it can be borne out and work towards it. That's how I would have probably dealt with that one. Anyway, I've said my piece. Let's hear from someone else.
I mean, I think socialists are optimists, right? You know, and the thing about being an optimist is you might not be right, but if you're a pessimist, you'll always be right. So the person saying it will never happen is a pessimist, right? You know, he's actually saying we can't solve problems. You know, we're going to be stuck with capitalism. And that's a pessimistic outlook, really, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, that's true, Dougie. They are pessimistic. And I often ask them, well, are you happy with the way things are? You know, and then you quote how many people are starving in the world, you know, and people near them, you know, what would you like to do that you cannot do because of the restrictions of the way we live? And then they sort of think about, well, yeah, I'm not very happy with it. So then you ask them the question, well, so, what, how could you change things? You know, and then they'll say, oh, but I can't do it on my own. Well, of course not. So this is the whole reason that we all kind of have to get together, because none of us can do it on our own. And the other one is that obviously the another comeback is, which just is not very good because it tends to just shut them up, is that if you don't think it will happen, then you're obviously not going to be one of those that's going to make it happen. And they get a bit miffed. And then they might sort of say, oh, you know, and put a few, then it might encourage conversation. Of course, it might just shut it up. But, you know, it's the thing, though, it'll never happen. That is the opening for all the whole excuses of you've got human nature, you've got the government's not going to allow it to happen. So, yeah, it is, you try and not to get, to give that opening, but you can't just ask them why they think it won't happen, because you'll get all those, you know, like Paddy said. But I think if you kind of try and focus it on their own personal life, because unless they've got plenty of money and quite happy with the way things are, you know, there's a good chance that they're not happy. And if they've got any kind of sensibility or heart, they're going to be concerned about the problems in the world. So I guess that, you know, you have to sort of say, well, look, you know, all these things. Plus the fact that, you know, things do change. We still all don't live in slavery. Well, we live in wage slavery, but we all don't live in slave times. We all don't live in feudal times. Why? Because things change. And who changes them? They don't suddenly happen by magic. You know, things change because people change them. You know, this is not a God-given way of life or a God-given society. We've made it like this. We can change it. That's my bit.
I tend to avoid the opener that asking somebody if they're happy with the way things are in the world, because that's what the Jehovah's Witnesses always say on the doorstep when they come round.
They don't say that to me. I don't even let them in.
Well, they can't convince me. I think... When they say it's not going to happen, I mean, if you get locked in to that question, it's a theoretical question, and I think the right strategy is to replace that with a practical question. So if somebody says it's not going to happen, do you want it to happen? And if you do want it to happen, are you prepared to do something about it? I mean, that it seems to me, keeps the question on the right terrain instead of making it a purely speculative question in the way that you might talk about some faraway astrological events. Is this going to happen? Is that going to happen? What do you want to happen? What are you prepared to do?
Well, I think that's a good approach. I like that. Has anybody tried the reversing the argument? I've heard this argument put a few times. I'm not sure if I've ever tried it, but the argument that actually capitalism is the real utopia that will never happen. Has anybody tried that one? You know, in the sense that capitalism is going to solve poverty, capitalism is going to solve war, capitalism is going to solve climate change, etc., etc. You know, when you put those things like that, it sounds increasingly unlikely. Just wonder if anybody's experimented with that approach.
And yes, the thing is, though, it's the same thing, because they'll say, well, this is all we've got. You know, this is the best we've got, and, you know, we can't change it. I haven't found that it doesn't really work. They know the limits of the system.
Recently, we were in our little Marxist group. We were having a look at dialectics, and the discussion came up that people don't have any sense of time, of the sweep of time, things changing over time. I wonder if this is another aspect of that, isn't it? That you know, people see the world as it is and can't imagine it as a sort of dynamic, or you might say, you know, a dialectical process. People just can't see it that way. What do you say to that?
I think people generally, unless they've had the light bulb, socialist light bulb moment switch on in their head, I think people generally are just struggling to get by and do the best they can with what they've got for the moment. They're so short-sighted, they're trying to do what they can for themselves, the nearest and dearest, presuming they have some, and just basically struggling along without having the foresightedness to. I mean, obviously there's a big deal being made of you know, the future of the planet and the green lobby and the environmentalists and stuff, who are a bit more forward thinking. But the average Joe, I think, is just more inclined towards trying to do the best they can with what they've got, and maybe looking at the next generation, at the very most their own children, rather than the potentially several generations down the line, and what could be, and how you know, we should be thinking that far ahead and getting the numbers up towards realising the potential, human potential that could be there, and how that, if anything, capitalism has been an inhibitor rather than an enhancer for the well-being of the human race, despite all the exciting achievements that have happened that you could point to. The reality is that it's been a retarder, if you like. It's slowed the progress of the human race down rather than speeding it up. Because of the limitations that financial considerations have on human progress, and that the only way of overcoming that is to dispense with it altogether. And the only way of achieving that is by understanding and grasping it, and obviously understanding it and working and cooperating towards that end. In other words, as was said earlier, Carla, I remember who said this was basically backing up what Carla was saying, which was a very good point, which we're all generally agreed on, and that is that we all need to want it to make it happen, and we all need to join together to make it happen. By constantly writing it off, all that you're going to do is prolong the agony of the current system.
Yeah, I think you're right, Paul. I think you're right, yeah. Paul. The way we go from school to work, we are trained to be realist. Oh, you've got to be realist. This is the real world. You know, no one dares to dream anymore. We're dreamers. We are dreamers. Nobody dares to dream anymore, because if you dream, or if you dare to dream, you're most likely to be incredibly disappointed. So I think, you know, with the restrictions of life and the hardness of life, people do not dare to dream.
Yeah. I think that's true. I think one of the major reasons why we don't live in a socialist society is because of a failure of imagination. And I wish I had the answer to this. I think that, you know, a vital part of trying to increase socialist consciousness is to get people to imagine things, get them to be imaginative. And I wish I knew how we could do that.
I'm interested by something that Paul said a minute ago. He said something about a light bulb moment. And I thought that was interesting. Is there such a thing as a light bulb moment, you know, some switch that gets switched on somewhere in our unconscious, maybe? I can't remember a light bulb moment. And when I think about, learning ideas, I recall it as being more like a jigsaw process, a kind of jigsaw that's still not complete, incidentally, but, putting things, bits together into the picture bit by bit. But before that, there must have been some motivation to put that picture together. There must have been some reason why I decided to sort of assemble this jigsaw in the first place. Is that the light bulb moment we're talking about? And if that's it, what is it exactly? And why is it turned on in us? Because we're these kind of freaks who do dare to dream, obviously. And but not in anybody else. We never seem to be able to put our finger on what that process is.
It's a difficult one. It's, you know, it's almost impossible to analyse and really grasp. But for me, it's just that moment in time when maybe you're struggling to understand and grasp something. The more you think about it, the more complicated and questionable it can be. But then suddenly something, you know, that sense of achievement, suddenly something just hits you and everything just sort of seems to fall into place and you can really sort of get it. You know, and it can happen across the board with many subjects. And when I describe it, it's not exclusive just to understanding socialism. It can be just about anything that you're maybe struggling to grasp. Some hurdles are greater than others. Then you start to break it all down. You imagine it. It becomes an idea, then an ideology, and then you take it to the next logical step of reality. And suddenly everything just, again, you know, using the jigsaw analogy, everything just seems to fall into place. And that can be practical, physical moments, but it can also be ideas and thoughts and understandings in your own mind. Suddenly everything just falls into place and you see, there's definitely something in that. And hopefully the more people that you can get to understand that. I don't think there's any secret formula or remedy. I think or antidote, you know, I think it's just something that just happens naturally. And for some people it can happen quicker than for others, you know. It can happen in any amount of duration time. It might take people years to really understand what the potential for socialism is, because it is a relatively difficult thing to get your head around. But when you do, voila, you've got your light bulb moment. That makes sense? Probably not.
Well, I'm wondering what. Yeah, you might be right. Of course, you might be right, Paul. That it's out of our control. You know, it's just a natural process. It just happens or it doesn't happen. I mean, that could be correct. But what if that's not right? And what if it's not out of our control and there is some kind of trigger and we don't know what it is because we've never really looked for it? Thinking along these lines, I was just trying to think, okay, light bulb, what could it have been? What could it have been? All right. Now I have this thing, right? It's kind of weird. I live in the bloody in the north of Britain where it rains all the time, weather's pretty horrible. Sometimes we get a really sunny day. Sometimes it's occasionally it's like Portugal, and it's just one day, and it's like that. And weirdly, I sometimes get a bit depressed when it's like that. And the reason is because I don't live in Portugal, and I don't get this every day. It's vanishingly rare. So when I have a really nice day, sometimes I just think, oh, why is it not like this all the time? Now, I remember a period in my life when I was just having a really happy time. I had some really good friends, and it was really social, and it was a whole crowd of us, and we did everything together. And it was just really nice and relaxed. Everything was really good. It all went wrong eventually, obviously, they always do. But at the time, I remember thinking, why isn't life like this all the time, just like the Portuguese weather? I wonder if that was a kind of point where I started to have that, maybe the kind of light bulb thing. Why isn't it like this? Why isn't life good all the time? What is going on? And the point of what I'm saying is that if that's, that was what worked for me, actually an idea coming out of a happy time, not out of a miserable time, that would sort of seem to suggest that the way we do our propaganda, you know, threat, 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 misery, 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 is actually the wrong way about to go about it. Dougie said it earlier that all socialists are optimists, and I kind of agree with that. But we don't see much optimism in our propaganda. It's all misery, misery, misery. Are we? And if there's a, you know, going back to the question, what might be the trigger? You know, is there a trigger that you know, switches people on? It's not going to be misery, is it? I don't think. Well, that's just switched everybody off.
I mean, I was just pausing to see if anyone else was going to chip in, but you're absolutely on the ball there, Paddy. I think there's no doubt about it. Without taking it to the point where you're painting an unrealistic utopian vision, I think it's absolutely imperative that positivity, even in those moments where you're feeling low yourself, and what's that bloody saying, laugh and the world laughs with you, cry and you cry alone, kind of thing. I really dislike that saying. There's another one that my dad used to always say to me as well, you've got to be cruel to be kind, all these kind of quotes and things are things that make me cringe. But nonetheless, there's not even so much an element of truth. I think people generally are drawn to and prefer to be around positive people, you know. That's not to say you have to be the life and soul of the party or Mr. Happy all the time, because we'll have our moments of quiet reflection and feel a little bit demoralised or worse still, depressed. But I think if it's absolutely essential to paint a positive picture of a future society, while at the same time reflecting on the negativity of the current society. But, you know, I think we all subconsciously or otherwise prefer to be surrounded by positivity and positive people than we do sometimes in the Scottish, we have a terrible reputation as being quite dour, you know, the kind of black abbots, as we're sometimes called, you know. It's whenever MD says, you know, the half glass, half full analogy, when MD says something, you know, positive and uplifting, you know, you'll always get someone that says abbot, you know, the black abbot, what about this? And abbot, what about that? You know, generally find a gloomy side to it, where I think you have to retrain your attitude in order to present a positive picture of what can be. And I think that has to be a priority, but striking the balance against getting the old sort of somewhere over the rainbow kind of picture. Yeah.
But that's the thing, isn't it, Paul? You know, I thought that's what we all do. We all paint a positive picture of a society that we'd like to see, except for when you start to go on about this society that you like to see, people look at you and think you're bloody mad, you know, and that, oh, you're living cloud cuckoo land, you. You know, and you get called a dreamer and you get called this, and it's like, well, okay. You know, it's a difficult one. It really is difficult. But I do agree. I think, you know, we need to... we need to be a bit more social mm-hmm. if we're going to attract people to us. I think we do need to be a bit more friendly. I don't think mm-hmm. we're friendly enough. Yeah, all those things. Mm-hmm. I don't, you know, we need to attract people to us that want to be with us, regardless of, well, not regardless, but I mean, in addition to our ideas.
Yeah, I'm totally agree with that. And it's all about maintaining that, you know, without being too kind of negative or pessimistic about the current society, you know, just try and keep an equilibrium on that, but describe about how much better it can be rather than about how bad it is type of thing. There we go.
I love your thing about black abbots. That's hilarious. I've not heard that before.
The old black abbot. But what about this? But what about that?
If you look around the party, you can see that there are some comrades who are in the party because they're against capitalism, and some comrades who are in the party because they're in favour of socialism. And obviously, in a sense, we all need to be both. But there is a question of emphasis, and I mean, to go back to Paddy's point about propaganda, you know, there is a balance to be struck between those two aspects, the degree to which we're critical of what surrounds us and the degree to which we try to build up an appealing and realistic picture of where we want to get to. And, you know, I think the tenor of what people are saying here is that we should put the balance more on the side of the positive aspect of a possible future society, and I think that's right.
I just wanted to pick up on what Carla said. I've just kind of come in on the tail end of this discussion. And what Carla said about, you know, when people come back to you and say, oh, you're crazy, you're a dreamer. And I found myself saying a few times that isn't it more crazy and more of a dream to ever think you'd get capitalism to ever be a good thing? And that kind of shuts them up a bit.
I think it shut us up as well, Mandy.
See?
No, that was mentioned earlier, Mandy. It was Paddy mentioned it. It's kind of making the reverse and asking basically, yeah, you know, capitalism is going to solve all our problems. And of course, you know, people know that it won't, but they don't see it. Don't see the alternative. Don't see it. It's difficult.
I think a lot of it's so much about presentation as well, isn't it? I mean, we're all just sort of regular people, you know. We don't really have any airs and graces. We've had so many good speakers over the years as well. Great for their own style and their own kind of way they put things forward. And, you know, some are a bit more lively and more animated than others. Steve Combe was a terrific speaker. I find Brian Gardner a really engaging speaker as well. Paul Bennett has got this kind of liveliness about him too. And of course, your good self, Paddy, Mike as well. But that's not to say there's any bad speakers. But, you know, we don't go to college, we don't go to university, we don't go to training. We are who we are kind of thing. For some, it comes more naturally than others. So, you know, I don't think, we certainly don't want to turn into kind of plastic kind of presenters and propagators, but I think the only thing we really need to try and resist doing is the black abbot type thing that I mentioned earlier, again, that you like, Paddy, and it's a case of just try to remain sort of engaging and bringing people along on the journey in as positive a spin as we possibly can. Spin being a pretty good kind of modern way of communicating certain arguments and such like, and just avoiding too sort of melancholy about the current system, but remind people of how much better it really could be.
Well, we don't have to be orators, do we? I mean, that would actually put your mates off, wouldn't it, if you started giving a great talk. But I think that the circles that you move in, they're basically on a par with you, normally, education-wise. They're just basically on a par with you. So I don't think we have to have any airs or graces, or I don't think we have to think that we need to be cleverer than we are. You know, it's just a matter of talking to people about their, our personal lives, just our personal lives, and the relevance of our personal lives in the society that we live, and how much better or nicer it could be. Or, yeah, you know, it's that we don't need to be orators.
No.
But we do need to engage. We do need to engage.
I think it's important to get to people to relate and identify as well, you know, rather than risk repelling people. You know, I think it's important to take people along on a journey. I'm talking about, you know, well, with friends and family too, but essentially strangers, people who you might never have met before. You know, I find that, what with my tattoos and stuff like that, that can quite often be a good talking point for people who have hopefully obviously recognised my arts, for example. Most of you have known me, and for those who haven't, I've got I think it's a nice big tattoo in my right arm of that kind of classic Marx image tattooed there, and occasionally someone will spot the other one of John Lennon Imagine in my other arm. Those kind of classic, iconic kind of images that most people can identify with. And they'll pick up on it, and the conversation will start up from there. So it is a good conversation starter. And quite often people will be able to relate and identify with what I've got to say and describe about a future socialist society. And, you know, that's one way of getting the conversation going, you know. But then it can work the opposite way too. I remember being a Chinese restaurant once, and the waitress who was serving spotted the Marx bust, and she had you all know the one that I'm talking about, and she kind of pretended to spit on my arm, you know, because obviously it's certain connotations. She this was in a restaurant when I was in Germany once, and this little Chinese waitress seen it, and she just, oh, she was obviously her experience of what was imposed on her dressed up as Marxist ideas didn't go down too well. But generally speaking, people will find it interesting and are happy to talk about it. And the party case in particular.
I mean, I read a book recently, you know, 21 Things for the 21st Century or whatever, and it was very good at criticising, you know, different religions, different aspects of capitalism. But he basically said at the end of the book, all you can do is meditate, really, you know, because he said everything's transient, everything disappears, but there's nothing you can do to solve things, you know. He seemed to think everything was just a story, really. You know, we're telling a story about how things can be better, and capitalism tells a story about why it can't, really. You know, so I don't know. I mean, I found the book a bit depressing because it didn't have any solutions or whatever. You know, I think we've got solutions for society if people want to listen, but if they don't want to listen, I don't think there's much we can do about it, really.
Yeah, we were talking about. We're talking about, you know, ways of relating and making the case relatable and stuff like that. But it occurred to me that, well, we're kind of assuming that this is all the assumption that we're talking to people we don't know down the pub. But actually, you know, quite often, well, I'm sure we've all got this thing where we've got friends or family who, you know, we already relate to, and they say it'll never happen too. And the reason they say it is because they've seen us. They've seen what we do. They've seen us, you know, working away, knocking ourselves out and not making any progress. You know, members of my family think like that, and they say it'll never happen because, well, you know, they can see for themselves that we haven't turned into a mass movement in the time that I've been in the party. So, I mean, you know, even with people that we already relate to, who understand our kind of who we are and our motivations and stuff, even, you know, even they say it. So I don't really know what we do about that.
And I think that's the most hurtful and upsetting, when your own family say things like that to you. I personally feel that. I feel, you know, if a stranger says it to me or whatever, it doesn't bother me, it goes over my head. But if your own family, it's like your own family don't believe in you. And it's quite, I find it quite hurtful.
Oh, I don't know. It just makes me laugh. It's just kind of, it's one of the reasons why you can't take yourself too seriously, because, you know, nobody else does.
It's true.
I find the more sort of resistance or negativity that comes my way from whatever source, gives me even more energy and determination, not to prove people wrong, but to energise and get even more determined to keep pushing and nudging things along in that direction. And it's interesting what Dougie was saying there. You know, for example, some of these self-help books, you know, they don't really offer solutions. All they do is try and teach you, and this is a big thing that's going on in Scottish schools at the moment, and I've had many a discussion, a debate with my oldest daughter about it, because she is a school teacher, and it's this building resilience, you know, whereas, and that's maybe all well and good, you know, rather than cave into the system, building resilience, but what my argument against her is that what it's doing is building acceptance, you know. Instead of accepting the system, you should be working to change it in order to try and this is very much my theory on all this, why this mental health thing is so prominent just now. But of course it's important people should know and accept and understand mental health, and it shouldn't be frowned upon to have mental health issues. But again, a lot of it is the government propaganda saying, you know, it's all right to be not all right, or whatever the saying is, you know, and to some extent that's true. But then again, you know, it's very much a case of it's this argument, the building, trying to build people's acceptance of things, you know, as I know it's, this is just the way it is, and I think you just need to accept it, try not to let it get you down too much and all the rest of it. Whereas, again, you know, I think an important argument against that is to be fighting not for acceptance but for change, rather than just giving in to it. And these are the sort of messages we need to try and keep putting out there, encouraging people not to accept it but to fight against it. As that song goes, if you tolerate this, then your children will be next. Sometimes that strikes a chord in people, particularly if they've got children.
I was wondering if anybody had encounters with other people that call themselves socialists. And I've found that they're so sneering about the SPGB because we're not seen. You know, we don't make a big show of being involved in class struggle here and now. And, they're really sneering and horrible. And I find that the most hurtful. You know, it's just like you're just ineffective leaflet distributors.
Yeah, Mandy, I found them the most difficult too. They are the most difficult. They are so, I guess we are stuck in our, you know, in our way, stubborn, but they are so stubborn. And yet, you know, and we're the armchair socialists. Yeah, they're the most, I found them the most difficult, actually.
Yeah, I've been talking very recently on Facebook to somebody from the SWP, you know. And, you know, it was quite a nice discussion because I was determined to keep it nice.
Mm.
And she was quite nice. I think she's written books, Laura something, can't remember her last name. I think she's written books on gender equality.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, and she's very eloquent. And she wasn't nasty, but just so dismissive. But, you know, I mean, I said to her, but the thing is, we're involved in the, you know, absolutely intrinsically in the class struggle, the only one, you know, that really matters.
So what was she saying?
Well, that you don't ever see us at rallies. And I said, you might see it, but we won't be waving an SPGB flag because that's not what the SPGB is for. We're, you know, the party is there to overthrow capitalism, not sod about with bits and pieces here and now that are wrong. And we're not saying that you shouldn't be there, and probably quite a lot of us will be there, but we won't be waving the SPGB flag, you know. And she says, well, there's no point in you being there at all. I thought, oh, dear me.
But have they got any further than us? No.
No, and I couldn't really take her on in that because I haven't got a good enough command of history, you know, so I couldn't really take her on in that. But and plus, I didn't really think that it would be a good response to be mudslinging, you know?
No, of course not.
And so I thought there's not really any point in getting into what, you know, what you ain't achieved if we ain't achieved it either. I'm just kind of getting down and dirty on the same level, which I didn't want to do.
No, you're quite right, Mandy.
I just came across a thing on LibCom the other day. I was looking for something else, and I found this old article from 2009. I bet some people here probably know the article. It's called Trot Spotting, and it's kind of a LibCom guide to the Trotskyist left, which is, of course, most of the left. And it really rips the piss out of them. I do recommend it, Mandy, as a sort of antidote to this sort of snotty attitude that you're getting. You know, these people who think that they're fully engaged in the class struggle and we're not, you know. And actually, and LibCom just rips the piss out of them. So it's, you know, I really do recommend that. It'll make you feel better.
I could recommend a couple of other things along similar lines. There's a guy called John Sullivan. He was a tutor for the WEA for many years. And there's a couple of his pamphlets available online. One is called As Soon As This Pub Closes. And the other one is called Go Forth and Multiply, where Forth is F-O-U-R-T-H, as in Forth International. And that is a very, very humorous rundown of various left-wing groups and the differences between them. It's a very kind, it's kind of gentle piss take. But also, he includes descriptions of the party, and they are, in fact, in both of those pamphlets, remarkably sympathetic. That's John Sullivan.
Yeah, it's a bit like that Citizen Smith comedy show from the back in the 1970s and stuff. I mean, you don't want to take to heart too much what these people say to you, because, like Carla said, they're not getting anywhere either, but they're just very full of themselves.
So, have we come up with the perfect answer? I don't think so. I think this is the most difficult one of all. Sometimes can't. It's really difficult to argue about. You know, people are so blinkered. They're so blinkered. They cannot envisage anything other than what they see in front of them. And that is the difficulty. They just don't see it, and they just cannot imagine.
One thing that I can remember trying with people, it probably doesn't work. It won't work with anybody under the age of about 40, I guess now. But one thing that I can remember putting is about the fall of the Berlin Wall. And, you know, anyone who can remember before that time can remember that nobody ever thought the Berlin Wall was going to fall down. I think that the party actually predicted that it wouldn't last when it went up in 1949, but they thought it would collapse after a couple of years or something. But so the party did predict that it would come down, but it didn't get the timing right. But, you know, generally we never thought that would change. We thought that the Iron Curtain was there, you know, forever. And when it came down in 1989, the world was absolutely astonished. And it happened over a matter of just a few weeks. And the drama was just, you know, it was world headlines day after day after day, one country after another, sort of like the domino effect. So with, you know, with people who can remember that, I tend to sort of mention that because it's one of those sort of key moments in history where suddenly, what's that saying about, you know, something about change can happen, years of change can happen in a week. And it was really, it was like that. And so we can't ever say, you know, what's going to happen tomorrow. And there could be another whole Berlin Wall sort of seismic change in society happening tomorrow. I think we've always got to keep in mind that we can't see what's going to happen tomorrow. And we just, and people who say it will never happen are making a huge mistake if they think that change is impossible.
I've used the Berlin Wall one. I've definitely used that one, the Berlin Wall. Great one. But you're right, yeah, things can change in a moment.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I've tried that as well. And I've also kind of, I quite like using the French Revolution. I mean, it was a capitalist revolution, but nobody knew it was going to happen until the state stepped out onto the tennis court. I mean, it's just like nobody knew it was going to happen until it happened. And you can't get a bigger social upheaval than the French Revolution, you know. So, I've tried that. But I was going to say earlier, it's like I'm quite thin-skinned, really. So I have a bit of a problem in that A, I'm thin-skinned, but B, I'm also quite quarrelsome. So I'm always getting myself into situations where I start finding out I can't really cope with it. So over recent years, I've been trying very, very hard, at least face-to-face. It's much more difficult online, but face-to-face. Of not actually trying to engage people in debates about socialism, but simply putting my point of view and just simply telling them what I think. And also, if they disagree, trying to find common ground. So instead of trying to sort of make a point, you know, here and now, no, this is wrong, you know, I don't believe this or you're wrong about this, I've been trying much more sort of playing a long game of just trying to get them curious about what I believe and getting them to start asking questions about what I believe. And I can't say I've met any more socialists that way, but I have a feeling that, you know, sort of things are beginning to penetrate. So that's just my pennyworth on that.